Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
How are you? This is me. Am I out of things that you want me to be?
So, consciousness, in a way, it's almost sort of better because it's all full of mysteries, consciousness. We'll do that as the last class. The exam, by the way, is in, pretty sure it's in here, on the Monday. Okay? And again, my course outline, that wasn't my fault. That was the fault of the internet saying the last day of classes was the 14th. But on the 14th, the class, the final exam, which is 100 questions, a little bit more concentrated in the last three lectures than on the first bunch. But it's 100 questions, multiple choice, just like you're used to. So it's like a regular test, except longer. That's all. So as I said, today we'll talk about memory, and we'll end up with consciousness later because of my ridiculous mistake. But it makes sense because we just did learning, may as well do memory. Because memory is probably an indication. I mean, this is a decent definition. Again, I like definitions, so may as well define this. It's a some indication that learning has persisted over time. And then you can ask, where does learning end and memory begin? And I can answer this simply, I don't know. It's like sensation and perception, right? They're separate things on one level, but they're intimately linked. Early on in psychology, there was a lot of study of memory, quite a bit. Because, of course, obviously, this is going to be something people will be interested in. The first person that really did this work was a guy named Hermann Ebbinghaus. This is back in Germany in the 1890s, and there's a picture of him. He's mostly beard, as you can see there. Ebbinghaus used nonsense syllables instead of using words for people to remember. And today we use words. We very commonly just give people lists of words and have them recall them. Ebbinghaus didn't do this. He thought that would be something that would, you know, some words are more common than others, which is an interesting thing to worry about. In fact, something we can worry about. The nice thing is now we have, for most, you know, languages where people are doing these kind of studies, you can actually get lists of how common words are. So you can take a bunch of words that are just equally as common, doesn't matter if it's in English or French or Japanese or German, you could get a list of equally common words, so you have to worry about that. He decided, well, I don't have that list. So he made up these consonant, vowel, consonant trigrams, they called them. So one consonant, one vowel, and one consonant. So you could think of a nonsense syllable like, let's say, T-O, what's something that's not going to be a word here? Oh, tob. So T-O-B, that could be one of them. And you get big, long lists of these things. Because he was trying to make something, you couldn't use something that sounded like a word, either. So he was trying to get things that didn't sound like German words, because he was German. And he made up these big, long lists of these things, and he basically studied himself. How quickly could he learn these lists, and learn them perfectly, and learn them in order, by the way. Okay, learn them in order. One of the big things he found when he started out was something called savings. This really is just the idea that if you learn something, so he'd learn a list and he'd learn it to perfection. He'd get it to the point where he could do it perfectly. Then he'd stop and move on to another list. He had a lot of free time, apparently. So he'd move on to another list, and eventually he's going to forget one of those lists. Let's call it list one, you know, the first one. But he has all the data, how many mistakes he made, how long it took him to recall it, etc., for each list. He then would go back and relearn the list, and he would relearn it more quickly the second time, calling that savings. We still talk about savings today. And savings shows up in all kinds of memory. Everything from learning lists of words, which you could certainly do, to remembering how to ride a bicycle. You know, if you've never played a video game before, it takes longer to learn the controls than it does if you have played that game and put it away for 6 months and forgotten the controls. That kind of thing. So, or throwing a curveball in baseball, or doing calculus, right? A lot of us had the experience when we went to university, haven't had math in a couple of years, at least, right? Some of you maybe longer, and you forget a lot of stuff. And in fact, it's so forgotten that you could have something shown to you, And you think, I don't know how to do that. You see the question. And then someone teaches it to you, and it takes you a lot less the second time. So savings happens, and it happens in all kinds of learning. It also happens in classical conditioning and operant conditioning, which we talked about last time. And it happens in habituation, the simplest form of learning. So this is a pretty big discovery. Basically, the problem that happened, this is all studying mental events, isn't it? Right? It's all about mental events. This is all about what's happening inside your mind. Well, the behaviorists like Skinner, Watson, who we talked about early on, basically took over psychology, partially because psychology was becoming kind of philosophical, and they didn't like that. Now, I don't think they'd say that much about Ebbinghaus. They still studied what they called verbal learning. But they said, no more studying mental events. Right? So nobody talks about memory anymore. Because it's a mental event. And you can't, according to a behaviorist, really measure memory. And I would agree with that. You can't actually measure memory. You measure the product of memory. Right? But you actually aren't directly measuring memory. So, and we talked about the cognitive revolution before. One of the big things, of course, that happens in the middle of the last century is World War II. And to break German and Japanese codes, information theory was developed by the Allied countries. And that led to the study of computer science. That led to really the invention of computers. And the idea of inputs, and then something being done to the data that are input, and then the data then being output. Because in essence, that's what a computer does, and that's what code breaking was doing. If that's the case, people started thinking, well, that might have something to do with how memory works, right? Stuff goes in, it's dealt with somehow, and you spit it out. So the cognitive revolution happens. And suddenly people start talking about memory again. And in fact, memory is extensively studied. It's studied not only in humans, but in non-humans. The idea that memory is something that's the domain of psychologists, not philosophers, is pretty well entrenched, and it's not going anywhere. We're pretty happy that we can study memory. It can be really simple memory stuff, like Dr. Keough does in our department, who studies, you know, singers' memories of pitches. I do stuff on memory that birds have for where they put food. Dr. Bloomfield studies memory in birds about how they remember their songs. And then you've got Dr. Dupuy, who's in our department as well. And what Paul Dupuy studies is memory of people in eyewitnesses, their memory for crimes. And then, like, you know, how the police should do lineups. So that's all still studying memory. So it's very broad. So just to show you, pretty much all of us, just off the top of my head, are somehow studying memory. Okay? Questions about that? Just a little bit of history and why we're here where we are. Okay. Let's get a framework for studying this, for talking about this today. Information theory itself talks about inputs and outputs and basically control processes. So what we're talking about is encoding. That's getting the outside, the external stuff in and turning it into a memory. Storage. So that's putting it somewhere in the cognitive system, and retrieval, and that's when you retrieve it, when you pull it out, okay? Just like, I mean, and think about this. Right now, you're encoding things, you're putting this information just simply by taking notes. Just simply by taking notes, you're going to be able to encode things, get them into your memory. And then it's stored somehow, and I'm not talking about how it's stored physiologically. That's a horribly interesting question that we won't really deal with here. Let's talk about just how it's stored sort of mechanistically. Just like I know how a computer, I know in very broad strokes how it works, right? I know that ones and zeros are written onto magnetic media. I know that. But beyond that, I don't know a whole lot. But I know you put information in your computer or write it down, and it's then stored. You can then do some process on it. Right? Doesn't matter what, filed away somehow. And then you retrieve it later when you write the final exam. We can call this the information processing approach to memory. Because we're talking about information processing. You're taking information and you're dealing with it. You're processing it. It's not just going in raw and coming out raw. You're giving it meaning. One of the key things you can do is give information meaning. And that's why I would say when you study, what you should be doing is putting stuff into your own words. Saying stuff to yourself. You look like an idiot doing this. You really feel look silly. That's why you should, you know, you always study alone, right? Because if you're sitting there talking to yourself and your friend sees you, you think, oh, God, I look like an idiot. But if you actually are talking to yourself, saying this means this, this means this, this is about that, you'll do better than if you just sit there and hope it sinks in. Like you did in high school, right? Where you just sit there and you'd read stuff and then maybe put the book under your pillow hoping through osmosis the information somehow gets into your brain. When you want to learn something more complex, especially, putting it into your own words really helps. Even just underlining things in a textbook helps. The people that really got this going, this is late 50s, early 60s, the information processing approach, and really sort of codified it, I guess you'd say, are Atkinson and Schiffer. And that's why we call it the Atkinson-Schifrin model of memory. Now, this is a simple model, and in fact, frankly, it's a little outdated, but the idea of using this framework to understand it is still useful. If you want to learn all about memory, there's a course second term next year, 3717. The course is called Memory. Okay. Atkinson-Schifrin says that we have basically three kinds of storage. We have the sensory register. Okay, we have short-term memory or short-term storage, and long-term memory or long-term storage. The sensory register stuff goes from here. There's been no processing at all here. This is basically sensation that's happening here. In essence, it's your retina if you're thinking about something visual. Okay? This lasts on the order of maybe a couple of hundred milliseconds, maybe 400 or 500 milliseconds. So less than half a second. Well, stuff on your retina is always changing. This information now goes to, again, another limited time storage system and limited space storage system called short-term memory or short-term store. Today we use the term working memory for this, which is perfectly appropriate and probably a better term. This also has limited capacity. And we know what the capacity is. It's somewhere between, it's 7 plus or minus 2, depending on the person, pieces of information. So you might be as low as 5, you might be as high as 9. You're not going to get any higher than that. This is very short term. This is, again, on an order of seconds, unless you do something with it. You might have a process here. One of the things you might use is rehearsal. So saying something to yourself. Right? Or you can even just sort of say it in your mind's ear, right? Like you just, if I tell you, I'm going to give you a list of words and one of the words is table, you start thinking of the word table, 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 table to try to remember it. Right? We oftentimes, in sort of popular parlance, when we're talking with each other, talk about short-term, I have bad short-term memory, and people think that means hours or days. No, it means seconds. Hours, days, and forever is long-term memory. Note we have two arrows here. Stuff goes from short-term, if it's processed, into long-term. A lot of the stuff that you have in short-term memory right now, it will not be put into long-term memory. Now, I'm going to say something now, and now it will be. But tomorrow, if I was to ask you what was described the T-shirt I was wearing yesterday, you'll go, I don't know. Well, now that you've noticed it, you probably will. Right? Because it's useless information. Right? Now, long-term memory, stuff's got to come in from long-term memory. You might want to call these control routines if you're interested in sort of a computer analogy. Control processes have to come in here because I'm speaking right now, knowing what the meaning of those words is has to somehow get into short-term memory so you can deal with that as well. Now, you also might see here, and this is essentially a limitless. It must have a limit. We only have so many neurons in our brains. There must be a limit. There has to be, but no one's lived long enough to reach that. By the time we have the technology to live long enough to reach the limit of long-term memory, we will also likely be able to download everything from our memory onto a USB stick anyway. So, Note also, we have a little dashed line here. This is theoretically, it may be the case that sometimes stuff goes from short-term memory, or sorry, sensory register, immediately into long-term memory. This may be where the idea of deja vu comes from, right? The idea of, oh, I've been here before. In fact, what it is you were, yeah, here before like a second ago, but for some reason it went all the way to long-term memory and made you feel like, oh, I've been here before. Yeah, well, you're just noticing that you're in the same place as you are. That's a notion for it, anyway. It's an idea. Deja vu is a pretty hard thing to study because you have to give people a sense of deja vu, and that's really hard to do. It's really hard to do. So that's the sort of model we're going to look at. Does this make some sense? Do you get the idea of how it works? Pretty straightforward. Good. Okay. So we're going to talk about encoding, storage, and retrieval today. Let's talk about encoding. Well, one of the things we can look at is automatic versus effortful processing. Right? Some things are processed automatically. When you read, if it's a language you're fluent in, you don't have to think about the words. You can just see those and they happen. You know what those words mean. Right? Effortful would be, well, again, think about learning a language. If you're first learning a language, and most of us have tried at some point had to learn a second language in school or something, you have to think about what does that word mean? What do those letters, how do they sound in that language or whatever? Right? So that's one thing to think about when we're encoding stuff. Some stuff happens automatically. We encode, if you're reading a book, it happens automatically. Like a book for pleasure. If you're reading a book, an academic book, sometimes it takes a lot of effort. And sometimes you can have the automatic part where you're reading and you don't do the effortful part and you've just read 4 or 5 pages and you realize, I don't know what any of this meant, but I have been reading for 4 or 5 pages. And I think we've all had that experience. We can talk about mass versus distributed practice. Mass practice doesn't work as well. You don't remember stuff as well when you put stuff all together, mass versus distributed practice, if you distribute it out. And there's all kinds of data on this in humans and in rats and in pigeons and in everything, that memory is better if you do it, if you study, for example, we call it studying, you're studying a list of words even, in small bouts. So let's say it's a total of 3 hours of study time. You will remember something better if you do an hour on, 5 minutes off, an hour on, 5 minutes off, and an hour on, than you do if you just do 3 hours studying the whole time. Tip I can give you is that when you are studying, you should at least every hour take a 5 or 10 minute break and get away from what you're doing, just to take a break. Right? Another interesting thing that we can see is something called the spacing effect. If you're typically we use lists of words. If you're studying a list of words in an experiment, if there is a space between the words, right, that you're studying, you're going to remember those words better. Now, obviously, if the space is 4 days long, you're not. But if I fire 10 words at you in 10 seconds, it's going to be a lot harder to remember those words than if I fire 10 words at you in, or whatever the hell I said, in a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Right? Because it gives you time, typically, to rehearse the words, to rehearse the items, to encode them. Okay. Now, again, obviously, if you take this to the extreme, if you did one a year, you're probably not going to do very well. There's also something called the serial position effect. And this is that early and late items in a list are better remembered. And this graph shows that quite nicely. If I was to give you a list of 10 words, and I was going to give you, let's say, 5 seconds between words. Right? And we could just make something up here so I could try this. And imagine you're actually trying to remember these words. And the first word I give you is chalk. The first thing everyone automatically starts doing is saying to themselves, chalk, 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 chalk. And then I say, hat. You go chalk, chalk, hat, chalk, chalk, hat, hat, chalk, hat, chalk, hat. Floor. chalk hat, floor, chalk hat, floor, chair, chalk hat, floor, chair, chalk hat, chalk hat, chalk hat. And I give you a bunch of other words. And then we end up with tree. And now I ask you to recall the words. The first thing you go is tree, because it's right there. It's in short-term memory. It's called the recency effect. That word you will remember, that's the first one. And you're gonna, the next thing you'll say probably is chalk. And we had any hat and chair, right? But some of those, if I had a bunch of words in the middle there, you're probably not going to remember those at all. This is still here, the recency effect, because the stuff was still in short-term memory. You could just recall it. The primacy effect shows up because that stuff has made it into long-term memory. The stuff in the middle, because of the limited capacity of short-term memory, as soon as something comes in, it knocks something else out. Right? And you then don't have time to encode it. So you probably never encoded whatever some of the middle words would have been. There's an easy way to get rid of the recency effect. There's a couple easy ways. You got to knock something out of short-term memory. Well, we could just wait a minute. And then it'll pretty much go away. You might say, Dave, but then what if you're just going tree, 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 tree? What if I made you count backwards from 10,000 by 17s out loud? That works. That's my favorite distractor task. Very often in memory experiments, you have these little distractor tasks. And people take them seriously because you make them math questions. And people are always afraid that a math question is somehow reflects their intelligence, like an arithmetic question. Or you give them, another favorite I've used, is give them a map of the world and say, label this. And people get really, like, because you know you always hear about people don't know where countries are and stuff, so people take that very seriously. And now worrying about that the last word was tree is the furthest thing from your head, because you're wondering, is that Paraguay or Uruguay? I know it's one of the Guays. Right? South America is two countries in South America. They're Paraguay. I don't know which is which. I think Uruguay is the one that has no... No, Paraguay is the one that doesn't have any ocean, right? Capital cities of countries. Another one of my favorites. Again, you got to get to make people feel like it's going to be important. They're going to try hard. You know, you got a bunch of Canadians. I'd like you to name the provinces from west to east and their capitals, please. That's not easy for most people, but people do take it seriously because you always hear, oh, people don't know anything about their own country. So the local, like the Canadian students get all, they try really hard, and the international students are trying really hard because they want to like, oh yeah, well, you know, I want to show them that, you know, we're part of the whole thing, and we're here going to school in Canada, and it's great. And of course, I don't care about any of those things. I just want to get that word tree out of your head. But my favorite still is count backwards by 17s from 10,000 and do it out loud. Because you can cheat if you don't do it out loud. But you see people go, okay, sure, 10,000, 9,980, three. And that's it. The word tree's gone. By twos is easy. By say, you ever count by 17s backwards? No. So it's hard. So you can get rid of that. You won't get rid of the primacy effect. Because that stuff's already stored away now, long term. I remember when my wife was working for a market research company in Toronto, back when I was in graduate school. And the way they studied, is a commercial memorable? Is they show people a series of commercials. They show them five commercials. And she said, I said, how? She can never tell me, I don't even know to this day what the companies were. Let's pretend it was Coca-Cola, because I know it wasn't, because I know they didn't have that account. But I said, how did the thing go today with the focus group? And she said, oh, it's good, the client's really happy. I said, well, that's good. I said, what'd you do? She said, well, what we do is we show them five commercials. So we show them the Coke commercial and a bunch of other ones, and then we asked if they remembered each commercial. I said, oh, that's great. And I said, and I presume you put them all in random orders, different for different people. And she said, no. I said, so the Coke commercial was last or was it first? She said, well, it was first. I said, yeah, let me guess, it was remembered second. The last commercial, right? She said, yes. I said, the ones in the middle weren't remembered hardly at all, were they? And she said, no. I said, you should tell your boss that I work as a consultant. It'll be $200 an hour. I then, of course, at the Christmas party where the drinks were free, told him this while I was drinking, which was probably a mistake. But it just shows that, you know, you can use this. It's even stuff like this is useful in things as what you wouldn't think of, like market research, advertising. We can also talk about encoding being done by different sensory modalities. So first of all, we can talk about semantic versus acoustic versus visual processing. We remember things better if we look at the meaning of the word versus its sensory properties, what it sounds like and what it looks like. And in fact, it works that way, that semantic encoding works best, then acoustic encoding, and then visual encoding. So if I was giving you a list of words, and I said, what I want you to do with these words is rate the pleasantness of their meanings from 1 to 7. You have to think about the meaning. So you're going to remember those words better than if I said, count the number of syllables in the word, because that's how it sounds. And that works a little bit better than count the number of letters that go above and below the line, ascending and descending letters. So like an L is an ascender, a Y is a descender, it goes below the line. The other name for this is conceptually driven, that's the concept, versus data driven, that's sensory properties. So it's also known as conceptually driven versus data driven processing. We remember something better if we think about its meaning. Again, pointing back to the idea that when you're studying, you should be putting things into your own words, because if you put them into your own words, it makes you think about the meaning. Right? We may actually encode imagery as well. When I said the word tree before, you probably imagined a tree. You kind of can't help it. So it might be the case that we do a dual coding. We think about the meaning and what it looks like. This is an idea that a guy named Al Pavio, who was at Western until he retired, was big on. He was the guy in the dual code theory. So he said we encode both the meaning of a word and what it looks like. An image of it. Okay. He actually compared concrete versus abstract words. Concrete words are words that you can imagine what they look like. Abstract words you can't. So tree is an easy one. Justice is a hard thing to imagine what it looks like. What does justice look like? I don't know. What does freedom look like? What do rights look like? You know. What does the word perfect look like? What does the word correct look like? What does chair look like? Oh, that one's easy. It looks like a chair. Okay? So, and this is a really pretty solid effect. This happens. There's no doubt about it. It's really easy. It always works. The question is why? And Al Pavio said it's because we are encoding an image of it as well. The guy literally across the hall from him at Western, Zenon Polishin, said, no, it isn't. It's something else. There's no way we're just imagining a picture of it and thinking about the meaning. So the key to the whole thing, according to Polishin and a lot of other people, is in fact meaning itself. And that, don't worry about this thing. I'm going to read this and it's just a demonstration. Writing this down would be pointless, this little paragraph. Okay, just letting you know. Perhaps concrete words have simpler meanings and more direct meanings than abstract words. So, and the idea is a picture, if you can imagine something, it helps you remember it. But it's not like the image comes itself. And this is demonstrated by this great experiment, Bransford and Johnson. What they did is they gave this paragraph, right? And then give you a picture of the paragraph. And if you get a picture of this little story, which you probably can't even imagine right now, it helps you to remember it. So the experiment, they just had this written out for people. If the balloons popped, the sound wouldn't be able to carry, since everything would be too far away from the correct floor. A closed window would also prevent the sound from carrying, since most buildings tend to be well insulated. Since the whole operation depends on the steady flow of electricity, a break in the middle of the wire would also cause problems. Of course, the fellow could shout, but the human voice cannot carry that far. An additional problem is that a string could break in the instrument. Then there could be no accompaniment to the message. It is clear that the best situation would involve less distance. Then there would be fewer potential problems. With face-to-face contact, the least number of things could go wrong. This is a hard thing to remember, and it's a hard thing to even imagine. What in the hell is this talking about, right? Well, what it's actually talking about, and these are the pictures they showed people. The picture on the left is actually showing, this is what it's about. This is some guy, he's got a mic, and I guess just a mic. And then he's got a little amp up here, and it's being carried up to the floor by balloons. They're obviously very powerful balloons. It's a very small amp. If you play guitar, it's one of those pig nose amps. You ever seen those from the mid-70s? Really cool little things? Could be. This picture over here shows exactly the same stuff. The same images. They're all there. But people, when they saw this accompanying image, couldn't remember the passage. When they saw this one, they did quite a bit better. Either way, I think it's creepy, and I think the guy's a stalker. You know, I'm pretty sure this guy's a stalker. Right? So do you see the problem here? What he's saying, what people like Polition and what Bransford and Johnson are saying is, look, the picture helps with the meaning. It's not that the picture comes from the words, it's the picture helps describe the words. It's a subtle difference, but I think they're right, because I think this experiment actually shows it, and I've also always thought it's a little bit silly that we also remember we have this dual code in there. So the context is the important thing here. By the way, these data show how important it is probably to read chapters before coming to class, right? Because it helps you to put what I'm going to talk about into, it sort of gives it context, right? Even when I do the wrong one because I screw up like I did the other day. But in general, that's not just in here, that's in any classroom, any class you're taking. Do the reading before if you can, because when the prof's talking, they don't just read the book. Well, maybe I had a prof in first year university that did. That was great. He sat down, he didn't even stand up. He sat down in front of us and read his notes. And then he'd read quotes from the book, and then he'd turn his page. It was horrible. You sit there for 4 hours a week listening to this guy. I learned a great deal from him, but it was really boring. Most of us, what do? We hit the high points, we throw in some other stuff that isn't in the book. That's the way it works, right? So if you do the reading before, no matter what the class, it allows you to put other stuff into context. It really helps you remember it. We tend to organize information in chunks and hierarchies. A chunk has a rather amorphous definition because it's circular. It's the smallest unit of information we can remember. And I just told you we organize stuff in chunks. It's kind of icky. Hierarchies are like categories, like that, okay? So a chunk is the smallest unit of information we can remember. A great example here is a phone number, right? People don't remember, you can just hear it by the way people say phone numbers, right? If you ask somebody their phone number, they will tell you, well, what's the university's phone number? Because I'm not giving you my home phone number. Well, you could look it up, but I don't want, please don't call the house. But if I gave you the university phone number, I'd say 949-2301. You see how I actually put that the way I said it in two chunks? Right? Those two things go together in sort of a hierarchy to make a phone number. Right? I remember it in two bits of information, two chunks, not seven. There's seven numbers in a phone number in North America, right? Well, then depending on Sometimes, depending where you are, you have to put the area code in front, but the area code's always going to be the same for everybody, so you don't have to worry about that. Right? Depending on what phone system you're on, if you're on the TELUS 3G network, for example, you have to put 705 in front of all your phone numbers here for your mobile phone. That'll be coming soon to Sault Ste. Marie 2011, I believe, where it'd be like everybody else, you know. Like if you're in Toronto, are you a 416? Are you a 905? Whatever, right? In London, same thing, 519 for everybody. But we do this. We put these. Remember when you were a kid and you learned your phone number for the first time? You're about six and your mom and dad are trying to teach your phone number just in case you have to make a phone call. And you remember it is seven individual numbers. Right? And eventually, very quickly, you become a phone number expert and you remember phone numbers in chunks of two. When you move to a new town, even within North America, it's hard to remember phone numbers for a while because you aren't used to the first three numbers, the exchange, as they used to call them, right? So if you moved here from out of town, the idea that phone numbers could start with 949 is just bizarre because where you're from, they don't. Right? So if you first moved here for school and you heard someone, you know, said that the phone number was, you know, whatever, 949-2301. Well, if they said that, they were lying. That's a university. But anyway, you would have trouble remembering that. And then about a month or so, you've got some phone numbers here, and you're fine. We tend to put things into meaningful units, and this is a great example here where Canadian postal codes are atrocious things to remember. Right? Because they're letter, number, letter, number, letter, number. It's hard to make a use, a thing you can remember there. It's hard to make it into something. I realize phone numbers are arbitrary, but they're three and four all the time. And they're all numbers, at least. American zip codes are easy, because they're just numbers. Canadian postal codes are obscene, right? What's the university postal code? P6A2G4. I still have to think about it. Right? In the UK, the first two letters of the postal code are the area you're in. So if you live in Oxford, your postal code starts with OX. It's a good idea. It's a very good idea. All they had to do was ask an experimental psychologist, how should we set this up so people can remember their postal codes? Right? How many times when you go to a shop, go to some store, and they ask you for your postal code, I always just refuse to tell them or I make one up. You know, A2H2X5. It's when I lived in Cornerbrook. I use that one. They'll look at me. Yeah, I'm from Newfoundland. Go with that. None of your goddamn business with my postal code is. It bothers me. It's like, why do you have to tell people your phone number when you buy batteries at Radio Shack? I just don't know. Anyway, hard to remember your postal code. Phone number's pretty easy. Because it's a chunk. We can put it into a chunk, a meaningful unit. Right? And experts are better chunkers than non-experts. As I said, most of us become phone number experts. But if you've ever moved to another country or visit another country and you get their phone numbers, they are bizarre. Right? I remember when I was in Oxford and someone told me their phone number. And they said their phone number was 08625. And they paused. I went, what? No, it can't be. That's got five numbers in it. Then I see trucks, you know, going by or whatever with their phone numbers on the side, and it's like, my God, that is their phone number here. Hard to remember, right? My wife was just in France. She said their phone numbers go like two numbers, two numbers, two numbers, four numbers. The hell is that? Right? I'm sure French people come here and they go, what do you mean, three and four? So it's very hard because you're not an expert. You become an expert very quickly. We all become phone number experts, right? You can also look at, like, grandmaster chess players, the top chess players in the world, versus really good chess players, masters. They're ranked like that, okay? If you take grandmaster chess players, the Garry Kasparovs of the world, and you show them a chessboard, they'll remember it better than a master player who's still pretty damn good. Funny thing is, if you show them a chessboard that has a piece that's in an impossible position, like both the bishops are on black squares, they're no better than you and I. what they're remembering is they're experts at chess situations, right? I've always figured this is kind of like when people say hockey players can really see the ice well, because there's no way they have better vision, probably. They probably all have pretty good vision. But I think when you know where someone's going to be, because you just have, I think they're chunking better. Experts are better chunkers than non-experts. People say to me a lot, how do you remember authors and years of studies? And I go, you just do. I don't know. It's just something that happens. Because that's part of my job. I have to remember when I say write something or when I say something in class, I have to say, oh, and that's the, you know, Bransford and Johnson, 1972. You just learn how to do it. It just happens, right? So encoding itself probably tells us that sometimes forgetting is just a failure of encoding. Stuff isn't getting in. It's never been put, it never got in the system properly. Okay? Any questions about that? All right. Now, storage, on the other hand, we can talk about, first of all, the sensory register. We can talk about the icon and the echo. The icon's visual, echo is auditory. It's hard to study the echo. But the icon, people have studied, and these are cool experiments. Okay, this lasts in the short time, very short time. We're talking less than half a second here. And this is unprocessed, raw visual information for the icon. Auditory for the echo, but you'll see in a second when I show you how people study the icon that you couldn't really do it with the what's called the echo. So it's raw, it's uncooked, it's not been processed whatsoever at this point when it's in the sensor register. So, here's how these experiments work. I show you this stimulus. It's just, what do we have here? 12 letters, right? But I don't show it to you that for that period of time. I show it to you for a 20th of a second. It's that fast. A 20th of a second. And what do? Because this is going to fade so quickly, I can't even say third one over on the middle, because it's going to just disappear. What I do is I train you up, basically, that if I play a high tone, right, just read off from what you see still in your mind's eye, the top row. A medium tone, the middle row, low tone, the bottom row. We can probably store about 12 things in sensory register. Now, to show that this is raw and unprocessed, a very cool thing is done. If I flash this, and then immediately, in the next 20th of a second, just show this, the with the X. Right? This is exactly in the same place as this G. So if I go bang, bang, you'll go J-H-X-F. That's really cool. This is one of the experiments that I learned about in the first year that said, I want to become an experimental psychologist. That's neat. I don't want to help people anymore. To hell with people. I have enough of my own personal problems. I want to find out how brains and memories work. That's really a neat experiment. Do you understand the experiment? This is stuff that was done by a guy named Sternberg, and it's just super awesome. Like, it's just, this is so cool. And the amazing thing is, it was all done with mechanical instruments and slides. It wasn't done with a computer. Today, I can time that out in PowerPoint. It'd be simple. But back then, I had a thing called a tachistoscope that would show a slide for a 20th of a second. Totally cool. Or a T-scope, as it's called sometimes. At the most, this lasts maybe a second. It starts to really decay pretty quickly after that. By the way, you might think, if I ask you to read the middle one, you still go MNBV, like in your mind's eye. So the X actually masks out that G. It takes its place. All right. So that's sensory register. I just love that because it's a cool experiment. But you have any questions about that? Okay. Now, in short-term memory, this is pretty brief. If the information isn't processed, what's in short-term memory is pretty brief. It lasts a pretty brief period of time. A couple of seconds. And it's 7 plus or minus 2 chunks. This explains, by the way, Supposedly, we don't really know this is true, but I've heard it said that this explains why phone numbers have seven digits. Probably not, because phone numbers were around before this was discovered. But I think it explains the reluctance of phone companies in North America to move to more than four numbers, or seven numbers, rather. Right? Some people as high as nine, some people as low as five. There are people that are disordered that have that can only store a couple of things in short-term memory, but that usually involves a stroke or a bump on the head. Now, what this shows is you can interfere with, if it's got a limited capacity, you can put new stuff in there which will knock out old stuff. Have you ever had this experience? A friend of yours says, call so-and-so on the phone. You know, we should call Steve, because Steve, we never got a hold of him. Make sure you call him. And your friend says, oh, what's his phone number? Because he doesn't have it in his phone. And he takes out his phone, and he opens the little phone app. And you say, okay, what's his phone number? And you say, 949-2301. And what do you do? While you're taking your phone out, you're going, 949-2301, 949. As soon as the person's doing that, just start yelling random numbers at them. 641-911. They go, what? Oh, it's gone. What is it again? 949-2301. They go, 949. They go, 94. And then you start saying things like orange, apple, chair, sky. It doesn't even matter if they're numbers. Don't do it a third time. You're liable to get a punch in the face. But what that shows is that people, when they have other competing information showing up, it will knock stuff out of short-term memory. Right? It just disappears. Don't do that very often. It's very mean. It's kind of funny, though. Today we talk about, with short-term memory, we talk about working memory. And working memory seems to have two components. It has the part we used to call short-term memory, the sort of 7 plus or minus 2 chunks. And that's going to have, we're going to call the phonological loop. That's what allows us to carry on a conversation, to remember the phone numbers. And we have another part of our working memory called the visuospatial sketchpad. What? Well, the visuospatial sketchpad is a whole other part of short-term memory or working memory that is where we basically plan out how to get places, where we're going and where we've been. Okay? And you might think that sounds really bizarre and silly and impossible, except that you can get a certain bump on your head that'll knock out your visual spatial sketch pad, but you can still have a phonological loop, still talk, still have a conversation. And it can go the other way too. So it seems pretty clear that, in fact, your memory probably does work this way. Questions so far? Making some sense? Doing okay? You guys are amazing. Long-term memory, it's probably limitless. Essentially, it is. Memory in the long term is limitless. Like I said, no, we haven't reached the limit yet. No one's lived long enough. We can talk about how long-term memory can be episodic or it can be semantic. This is an idea that Endel Tolving came up with. And there he is there, from U of T. Episodic memories are memories. They're episodes. They're autobiographical. They're about yourself. They're self-referential. Tolving would say they require consciousness. Semantic memory is facts about the world. Tolving always used to say, I went to school at U of T and he was there, that's why I say that. He would always say that episodic memory is knowing what you had for breakfast. Semantic memory is knowing what breakfast is. And in fact, you can get a lesion in your brain that will wreck your semantic your episodic memory, but your semantic memory is intact. Remember the case of HM. He couldn't learn anything new about his life, but he could learn new facts about the world. These are what's called dissociable. You can pull them apart both through physiological means, so somebody gets hurt somehow, but you can also pull them apart. Whoops. You can also pull them apart In a lot of other ways as well, and we'll talk about those. But the key thing here really is that with someone that has, usually it's an accident of some sort, but it could also be a stroke, a lesion of some sort. They can have, usually it works this way, they have no episodic memory, but they do have semantic memory. So their episodic memory is gone. Well, they can't form any new ones. There's a case, like HM, remember him, he couldn't form any new episodic memories, but he could remember his old ones. There's a case of a guy named KC. He can't remember, he's still alive, HM died a couple years ago. But KC, who had a motorcycle accident and got rather nasty temporal lobe damage, can't remember any episodic memories.
None.
Which is really amazing, right? Think about it. Like, he knows nothing about himself. He's got semantic memories, but no episodic ones. So if you ask him a question, and I think he used to be like pretty handy, like with mechanical things and stuff. If my memory serves me correctly, he used to do stuff with Volkswagen Beetles. That was like his hobby. He played with them, you know, mess with the engines, and if the old ones, not the new ones. And if you would ask him a question, a technical question about a Volkswagen Beetle, he can tell you. And then you can say, "How do you know that?" And he looks at you completely honestly and says, "Doesn't everyone know that?" He doesn't say, "Oh, that's just something I'm interested in. It's one of my things. I play with old air-cooled Volkswagen engines." Right? So they're dissociable. They are two separate kinds of long-term memory. This makes you think of something called flashbulb memories. I don't know why that always comes up first. These are memories of shared cultural experiences or big events in your life that seem to be hyper-accurate and very detailed. And they're almost always a cultural experience that we all share, or there's something like a big experience in your life. And here's some examples. There's Paul Henderson scoring the goal in 1972. There's us winning the gold medal in 2002. I don't have the 2010 picture yet, the poster. I'll have to get that. Some of you may have heard your parents or grandparents talk about where they were and exactly what was going on when President Kennedy was shot. Some of you may remember where you were when Princess Diana died. It was a big cultural event. Of course, I'm sure we all remember where we were when those maniacs flew those planes into the World Trade Center. This was a big moment in Canadian history because we'd never played the Russians. Our professional hockey players never played the Russians before. And in fact, the whole country stopped, and probably none of you guys know this, but the whole country shut down. And I was in school, and I was going to Crestaven Public School in Toronto. And we went down to the gym. Actually, if you remember the Coke ad during the Olympics, remember that one that said, "Make sure the whole world knows whose game they're playing," and they show all the kids watching these big old TVs? That's what that's supposed to signify. We all went down to our school gyms and watched a hockey game, because it was on in Moscow. They shut the school down. So you're watching this, pretty cool. And we score with 31 seconds left to win the series. Right? Paul Henderson from Phil Esposito, from Sault Ste. Marie, and Yvonne Cornouaille. Pretty exciting moment. People that didn't even like hockey were watching hockey. I looked at the little girl beside me and I hugged her. And I was in grade 2. You don't hug little girls when you're in grade 2 because you get cooties, you know? So I'm not going to hug a little girl. So I remember that. I also remember who the little girl was. A girl named Maria. There's one problem. I didn't meet Maria till 1974 when I moved to Sudbury. And that was in Toronto. In my memory, Maria is sitting right beside me. She can't have been. She lived 500 kilometers north of me. But in my memory, I hugged Maria. What? How can that be? I can't have hugged Maria. It's impossible. I didn't know her until we moved to Sudbury. I guess we moved to Sudbury in 73, but still, that was in September of 72. Well, my memory's making a guess. That's what's happening here. What's the best guess? Well, it's a little girl. Who's the first friend you had that was a little girl that you remember? Well, it's Maria. She lived across the street from me in Sudbury. Well, let's put her in it then. It's probably her. Now, I know it can't be her, but my memory tells me it is her. Many of us think we know, think we saw the second plane hit the second tower live on TV. Nobody did. That wasn't shown until a couple of hours later. And of course, we've all seen it a billion times, right? Everybody was watching the same sort of camera angles. They were talking to reporters on the ground. At that point, everyone thought it was an accident. Nobody was looking up at the second tower, waiting for the second plane full of nut jobs, well, some nut jobs and mostly innocent victims, to hit the other tower. It was amateur video that got that later on in the day. It's an amazing thing to think of, but most of us didn't see that. In fact, unless you were standing there in New York looking up, then you would have seen it live. People report when Kennedy was shot, they report that they watched the shooting happen live on TV. Nobody saw the shooting live on TV because, you see, we didn't have 24-hour news networks then. He was doing a tour and he was in Dallas. Now, everybody's seen the film, you know, and then his head goes back and to the left, you know, like from the Zapruder film, right? And then Mrs. Kennedy grips across and grabs part of her husband's skull on the back of the car. It was seen on the news and then it disappeared and wasn't seen again because it was evidence in a crime. Huh. People report having seen that live on TV. They didn't show presidential things like that live on TV because there was stuff to watch on TV that they wanted to watch. So, just an interesting thing. Any questions about that? Hard things to study, flashbulb memories. My buddy, old friend of mine, Les Cake, back in Newfoundland, the day of 9/11, thought, oh, here we are, here's one. And he made up a quick little set of questions and he handed them out to the class. And he said, please fill this out with everything, the way you felt, so it was the way you felt, and any details. And then 2 years later, he had people fill out, go back and fill out the same questions. People were really good at the emotions. They remembered the emotions. The details, no. You know, what are you wearing? Who is sitting beside you? Who's the first person you talk to? People are good at that. But they are good at how horrified they were and how frightened they were and how just shocked, etc. They're good at nailing the emotion. Let's talk a bit about how stuff might be stored in the brain. One of the ways might be something called long-term potentiation. What this is long-term potentiation is this situation where when a neural circuit is fired, this is in hippocampus especially, the first time it's fired, the next time, then if it's fired again, it's going to fire more quickly. The circuit works better. And it seems important for memory, because if you block it, it's harder for an animal to learn something. Is it new connections between new synapses, new connections between cells? That seems pretty likely. But it's not really clear yet. There are hormonal effects on memory. We've talked about that before, right? Early on in the course, right? So spatial things are better remembered depending upon the amount of testosterone you have in your system. There are chemical effects in general. So depending on your sort of state of your body at the time, that'll help you remind you of something. But this is even true of, I think that's the next point. Yeah, not quite. But there are other chemical effects, like just drugs. If you learn something while taking caffeine, you will remember it better by taking caffeine, when you take caffeine. So just a little, again, another hint, when you're studying, if you plan on having a coffee while you write the final exam, drink coffee while you study. If you smoke, don't smoke when you're studying because they're not going to let you get up and have a smoke in class. It's not the 50s where you could do that. It's like Mad Men. So it's also the case that stronger emotions, and this makes a lot of sense because there's cascades of things like adrenaline, etc. during strong emotional times. Strong emotions lead to stronger memories. People remember stuff better if the emotions are stronger. That means happy or sad. We don't tend to remember as much of the mundane. That makes a lot of sense biologically, doesn't it? Think of that evolutionary perspective I keep talking about. You should remember when a saber-toothed tiger almost killed you, because you were probably doing something that got the saber-toothed tiger angry. Maybe you should stay away from where they live. Or those damn cougars in Red Dead Redemption that keep eating my perfectly good horses. All right. Different forms of memory. You got episodic versus semantic. That's that Tulving idea we talked about. Larry Squire talks about declarative versus procedural. Pretty similar. Episodic and declarative are roughly the same. Semantic and procedural are roughly the same, too. So it's facts and how you do things, procedures. So that's pretty similar. The key to all this stuff, from getting stuff into long-term memory, is probably hippocampus. Seems pretty clear. Removal of hippocampus leads to the loss of the ability to encode things and put them into long-term memory. That's what it does. It's consolidating long-term memories. So hippocampus is pretty important here. There's also something called implicit versus explicit memory. This is different, because in fact you don't need a hippocampus to do implicit memory. Implicit memory tends to be stuff that you don't know you have. It's implicit. It's sort of unconscious memory, if you want to get all Freudy on me. So, that's studied through priming. Priming works like this. I show you a list of words. One of the words we're going to say is this: coffee. Okay? I can ask you to recall some of the words. You might recall coffee. I can also ask you to fill in the blanks in the following. Complete that. There's a lot of ways you can complete that. Cone, cocoa, brown liquid, or coffee. Corn, I don't know. The neat thing is, you're most likely to fill that in as coffee if you've seen the word coffee just previously. It's fragment completion, okay? We're going to complete that. You don't need to have seen the word coffee to do this. But if you have seen the word coffee, you're more likely to fill it in as coffee. The cool thing is, you're remembering the word coffee explicitly, so I say, can you remember some of the words, has no bearing on if you fill this in as coffee or not. They're two separate kinds of memories. This is called priming. Remember I said that little babies show priming? We do it with little babies with pictures, because they don't read. The cool thing is, even amnesiacs show totally normal priming. So if you do with KC or HM, before he died, they show totally normal priming. Just like you and I do. See what happens here, and you can see this. Recognition memory. So I just show you the list of words. One of them's got coffee on it. You recognize that. You say, yeah, that was on the list. That decays, though, doesn't it? See? From 1 hour to 7 days. Drops down. Priming's steady. The words you've seen before, you are more likely to fill in to complete the little fragment there than ones you haven't seen before. Which is pretty neat. There's Tulving's name again. This has even been shown in non-humans. So in pigeons. Do it again like you do with babies, you do it with pictures. That was me. And then also what? Keynes and Broadbeck, 2008. Then again, a buddy of mine's trying it with monkeys and it's not working at all. Which is weird. And it bothers me. So this is that implicit memory. It's a memory you don't need. You don't even need to have seen the word coffee to fill this in properly as coffee or anything else. But it does help you. But it's memory you don't know you have. When we do these experiments, these priming experiments, at the end of doing the fragments, we say to people, did you notice anything about those fragments? And people say, no, I just filled them in the ones I could do the best I could. Did you know that half of those were things you've seen before? And they go, no, I'd never even noticed, because you throw them at them pretty quickly. So let's retrieve stuff. Now we've got to pull it out. How do we get stuff out of memory? Well, one of the things that gives us some indication of how this works is a phenomenon called recognition failure of recall. We recognize stuff better than we recall it. Multiple choice tests then are probably easier than fill in the blank tests, because you've actually got to recall what word goes in the blank. Multiple choice, the answer's right in front of you. Why is that? Well, how do we remember things? We use what are called retrieval cues. So when we encode things, we remember all kinds of other stuff that goes with it, like little, almost like tags. Okay? The ultimate tag is the item itself. So that's why we're more likely to recognize something than to recall it. How many times have you done this to try to, you know, you get up to do something and you, sometimes you're like, what the hell? What am I looking for again? And you retrace your steps. You go back and you sit down, you stand up and go, right, my keys. Because the retrieval cues are there. You sit in the same place, you're in the same chair, you're looking at the same TV or whatever, and you recall it. So retrieval cues themselves, they're all these context effects. Again, study in the same place where you write the test. That's not an easy thing to do. We don't usually just let you into classrooms because we're afraid you might break in and learn something. But if you can study in here, that'd be great. You know what the nice thing is? Usually you don't get to write your test in the same room where you take the class. This time you're going to be able to. Marks will be better. It's a good thing. Well, we say study sitting up, wearing clothes, not wearing like pajamas, just like you'd be at school, because it helps you remember stuff. This might also explain deja vu. So here's another possibility. It's like it feels like you've been somewhere before because you've been in exactly this situation. It might. Again, it's a hard thing to study experimentally. There's state-dependent learning, and that's what I talked about with the drugs. Caffeine is an example. But also, this explains happiness and when you remember, you're more likely to remember happy things when you're happy and sad things when you're sad. The state you're in is a retrieval cue. So drug taking or emotions can act as retrieval cues. Right? In fact, one of the interesting effects that you find with depressed people is they're more likely to remember a list of nasty words than a list of happy words. Most of us remember happy words much better than neutral words or sad words. Not depressed people. They remember sad words better than neutral or happy words. So they remember words. If you give them a list of words, you know, joy, fun, excitement, death, destruction, genocide, they can remember those last three better than the first three. Because they're already kind of not doing so hot. All right. Questions about that? It's kind of cool, seems to me. All right, let's talk about interference. Now, I talked a little bit about interference when I was talking about encoding, right? But throwing out other numbers and letters. My voice is going. So, we've already found that forgetting may be a failure of recall, and it may be caused by two kinds of interference, proactive interference and retroactive interference. The example I always use here is when you're trying to find your keys in the morning. I don't know about you, but I very often can't find my keys. Right now, I don't know where the hell my baseball cap is. It's driving me nuts. I know it's in the house. That's all I know. Because I don't know where the hell I put it. But if I'm looking for my keys in the morning before I'm coming to work, I look around. It's like, oh, I know where they are. They're on top of the TV. You know, on top of the TV, I shouldn't say that. We don't, TV doesn't have a top anymore. It's a flat screen. They're on, the armoire in the kitchen. So I go in there like the pantry thing. Go, oh, man, that was yesterday. You suddenly remember. It's proactive. It's stuff from before interfering with now. Oh, I bet they're... Oh, I know where they are. I know where they are. Now I remember. They're on my dresser. Oh, that was a couple days ago. That's right. And finally, it's like, I bet I left them in my jacket.
Ah, that's where they were.
And I find them. On the other hand, sometimes you think, okay, where's my cap? I've been doing this all day and it's driving me crazy. When I come in the house, I probably took it off and put it with my other stuff, right? That's what you do. So I think, where did I put my stuff the last time I had my hat, which was last Friday? Then I think, okay, I know where it is. It's right by the little bench where you sit down to tie your shoes before you go outside in our front hall. And that was this morning or yesterday when I put my stuff away. It's retroactive. It's stuff from more recently interfering with older stuff. So you can have proactive interference and retroactive interference. Of course, the solution here is always put your stuff in the same place, but that would mean I would be smart. Then again, competing information can help if it's not really competing. Like if you think about it, knowing how to do, let's think of an example, I don't know, knowing how to do math of one type helps you do math of another type if you've already learned something. Right? Knowing some biology, remember we did all that biological basis of behavior. Knowing some biology, maybe having learned about the nervous system in another class, will help you learn about it in this class because maybe it's some of the same material. So we're going to call it competing information because it's either old or new going back. It can actually help. So it's not always bad. We call it interference when it's not interfering, we just call it transfer of training. We just give it a different name. Or savings, right? I already talked about savings in Ebbinghaus. I'm going to read you a list of words. Now, if you have the PowerPoint slides written out, that's fine. But I'm going to read you a list of words. Don't say anything about them. Don't note anything about them. Please don't write them down. Pin, inoculation, haystack, sharp, pointy, knitting, phonograph. Your memories aren't perfect. What they do is they reconstruct things. Remember I was talking about thinking about that little girl Maria is sitting beside me watching that hockey game. It's impossible. There's no way. It's not a VCR, a digital video recorder. It's not the recorder on the back of your phone. It's not recording every event. It makes guesses your memory. And it only encodes things that are necessary. Right? You can affect how an eyewitness recalls a crime or a crime scene by just changing the way you word the question. Classic experiment, Elizabeth Loftus. What's she do? She says to people, okay, watch this video of two cars. And they have a little tiny accident, little fender bender. Nothing big at all. Then she asks them, half the people are asked, how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? People make an estimate. The other group is asked, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? When you're asked, when they smashed into each other, people report about 16 kilometers faster, 10 miles faster an hour. People report seeing broken glass when there was none. This is why you always see in those lawyer shows when I object, it's a leading question, Your Honor, right? That kind of thing. Eyewitnesses, in fact, are horrible in court. They're the worst kind of evidence. The best kind of evidence is real, other kinds of evidence. Eyewitnesses are easily manipulated. And Paul Dupuy in our department can tell you the way that they do lineups basically is horrible as well. They should be done one picture after another. You should never have live people, and you should never have them all lined up with each other. There's a way to do it that gets rid of this kind of bias, but it's hard to convince police of that because they've been using the other way for so long. So we fill in gaps with reasonable guesses. If I tell you the cars smashed into each other, you're going to say that they were going faster than if I just say when they hit each other. Young kids are very prone to this. You can plant a false memory in a child easily. You can tell a little kid, this is a great experiment, by the way, another one Elizabeth Loftus did. Little kids, and she picks something that would be traumatic, and she wanted to make sure it never happened, so she talks to the parents first and says, did your kid ever get lost at the mall? That's happened. It happened to me when I was a kid. It's a little disorienting, not very much fun. Kid gets lost at the mall. So she tells the kid he got lost or she got lost at the mall. I was talking to your parents, you got lost at the mall. And most of the kids say, I don't remember that. That never happened. She gives them details. The next time they come back in a week, can you tell me what time you're lost in the mall? The kids fill in all these great details of what happened the time they got lost in the mall. You think, yeah, they're kids. Then she did it with university students. She had to find out, again, from relatives and friends, had this person ever been lost in the mall? We've all gotten lost in malls. Seriously, you ever go to a really big mall, you get lost? Like that big one in Edmonton? Well, I don't know, they got a Navy there. They got submarines in that mall. But all you do is you find these people, and you say, were you ever... So she gets their parents' information. She calls the parents, say, when they were a kid, when your son or daughter, I'm doing an experiment, when your son or daughter was a kid, were they ever lost in the mall? Most people, no. And the ones that said yes, say, okay, I'm sorry, thank you very much, can't use your kid in the experiment. The other ones, though, she then says, I was talking to your parents for this experiment, nothing more, to find out an interesting traumatic memory in your life. And they told me about the time when you were 5 years old and you got lost in the mall. And this is to people, you know, 18, 19 years old. And people were like, really? Never heard of that. I can't remember it. Come back a week later, guess what? They all remember getting lost in the mall. And they never have been. So those are adults. You can put a memory in. Because see, why would she lie to you? It's a good guess. So then you fill in gaps. Oh yeah, sure. I was in, let's see, where you grew up in Sault Ste. Marie. It was the Station Mall. And I was at EB Games. And I was getting the game. And I couldn't find my parents. And it was horrible. And I cried. And that's adults. We don't forget traumatic experiences. Right? We remember traumatic experiences. I've talked about that. We don't block them out. It would be nice if we did. It would be, in fact, I think most people that have had traumatic experiences wish to hell they could have them blocked out. They don't tend to. What tends to happen is we remember the traumatic. The idea that you have repressed memories has been shown over and over again, experimentally, to just really not be true. We don't have repressed memories. We probably wish we could repress some nasty things that have happened to us. We don't. We remember traumatic things. On the other hand, you can be told something happened to you and then suddenly remember it. All right. Now, remember these words I read to you. If you've got them, please, I hope you didn't write them down. Put your hand up. Try not to be influenced by anybody else. Put your hand up if those words... If these were on there, on that list that I read before, okay? Pin. You put your hand up if you heard pin. Okay, good. And that was on the list for sure. Book. No, book wasn't on the list. Chair. Nope, you're right again. Chair, mostly got that right. Chair was on the list. Ceiling. Nope. Sharp. Was sharp there? Yeah, sharp was there. Pointy. This right? Haystack. Yeah, for sure, that was there. Needle. Nope. Now, typically, don't feel bad if you said needle was on the list. This demonstration was done for us by a guy named Roddy Roediger, famous psychologist, Rice, I think he's at Rice University in Houston. He was at a conference. He was a big speaker, keynote speaker at the Canadian Society for Brain Behavior and Cognitive Science. 200 of us in the room. Most of us PhDs. And he said to us, I'm now going to implant a false memory in you. And we're all like, oh, bullshit. So he shows us the list, and then he does exactly what I did. Then right back into the rest of his talk, and then he goes with the list. And we're all, I said, yeah, needle. But let's look at that list. Let's go back. How do I do that? Let's see here. Nope. Pins and needles. You get an inoculation, it's a needle. Needle in a haystack. Needles are sharp, needles are pointed. There are knitting needles, and phonograph and a record player have needles. Needles should be on that list. It's not, but it should be. It's a good guess that it was there. You can do this, by the way, with a lot of things. Do with bird. So you go with feathers, nest, eggs, flies, beak. Do that one. You can do it with sleep. You go with bed, pillow, night, tired, everything but sleep. It's easy to sort of put a false memory in somebody, but it's also the case that that was a good guess. It should be there. It just turns out it's not. Questions about memory. You guys are amazing. You just learn things. Okay. Yeah, so next time we'll finally do consciousness, 2 weeks or 2 classes late. I'm sorry about that again. It was my mistake. You will all get a bonus point in the final exam because I'm an idiot. Thanks, guys. Taking no time at all.
Charlotte 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/brodbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.